We're going to now hear what the future holds, and our speaker will be Professor Mike Flynn, who is at the Computer Science Department at Johns Hopkins University and is chairman of the architecture group of the Computer Society of the IEEE, and has had a long and distinguished career in the design and implementation of large-scale computer systems. Mike is going to tell us about the future trends in microprogramming.
I'll note that an essential feature of all of the things that we talk about is fast storage. Fast has to be defined in a relative way or a qualitative way, because it's fast with respect to the combinational decisions of the system processor. Every microprogram system must have a fast storage, a storage whose cycle time is approximately the same time as it takes to make one logical, combinational, controllable decision, since we look to the storage for the control. Over the recent years, the growth of interest in microprogramming has roughly paralleled the recent growth. There was a period 20 years ago when there was a significant interest in microprogramming, but the recent growth in interest in microprogramming has come about because of the development of very fast memory. Let's look at what this means to an instruction, and then we'll get some idea as to where we're going with microprogramming. Slide one, please. In a traditional instruction, we had the following sequence. Given slow memory, let me define a combinational decision as something intuitive, not to be questioned further. Cycle time of the processor, register to register transfer, to give you some intuitive feel as to what it is. Systems of the second generation and third generation typically had a slow memory which would take about 5 decision times or cycle times before it could fetch its data or instruction. The access time. It might take 5 cycles for an instruction fetch, a couple of cycles to decode and generate an address, a couple of 5 more cycles to fetch the data, and finally execute the instruction. From this point, from zero time out to about 13 time, as it's shown there, is really the overhead to a subroutine, linkage into a subroutine. This last part of the instruction is the actual execution of the subroutine. The rest of it is just merely a convention to get fixed amount of data and information into the subroutine, which in the turn will be executed. Figure 2, please. With a microprogram system, with fast memory, we're able to make a control access in a cycle to get the instruction, to execute that instruction in the next cycle. Right? If memory is fast enough, you access in the first cycle the data and, well, let's say you access the information. The second cycle, you access the data and execute the instruction. So you orient yourself towards very primitive instructions. And what happens is, instead of you're processing on the average of 1 instruction every cycle rather than 1 instruction every 17 or 20 cycles, whatever it is. What does this mean in the near term? What does this mean to processors? Its meaning is rather variable. It depends a great deal on who you're talking to. If the manufacturer has a great investment, a large investment in his second and third generation instruction sets, in the way he's been doing business, it doesn't mean very much. Let's say superficially, it doesn't mean very much. He's not going to try, for example, to make the processor, to make these kind of instructions do a great deal more for him, because the only interface that his users will see will be at the higher level, or the old level of instruction. Why does he want to retain the old level of instruction? He's forced to retain it because of his massive investment in programming systems, in maintenance procedures, in training of his field personnel, etc. This is indeed the right decision for him to do. Regardless of how technology changes or resources change, his investment in the logical facilities that surround the processor is so substantial that he wants to retain this particular view of his process. Let's presume we're talking about a smaller user, smaller process designer or manufacturer. He has a number of options open to him in the future. He can emulate, he can try with this technique to create a system which will be a universal host or a host to a number of different systems, for example. Or he may choose to emulate none to allow the user to come in and directly modify this. What indeed is the user doing? He's merely programming. It's just it's the same type of program that he was doing in, let's say, certainly the early 50s, when indeed we had the same type of balance between execution time of the instruction and access time. All he's doing is programming. So we give this fancy word microprogramming to something really rather old-fashioned. Emulation is the difference, though. We can execute 20 of these little bitty instructions for every one second or third generation instruction. Now, with the availability of this fast memory, we have the option to do, essentially, 20 of these little instructions and make it look like we have accomplished exactly the same thing as one big instruction, or old-fashioned instruction did. To really take advantage of this, though, there's something implied in this figure, which I really haven't spelled out very well, and that's that I can get the data also in one cycle. All right? And this distinguishes the current interest in microprogramming from the interest of about 5 years ago. 5 years ago, we were limited in access. The only way you could get an access time of one cycle was to go to a read-only storage. With monolithic technology, you're no longer limited in that way, and now we really have the same type of system as we had in the early 50s in terms of logical balance. Now we can get our data and instructions can both be stored in the same media, and the media is changeable. Thus the significance of the writable control store. One question that faces the field now, microprogramming, is really regards this assembly type or second generation type instruction. It exists now in all of its glory because of certain premises on storage, as I mentioned to you. You wanted to have a sophisticated instruction because you were trying to write that little execution time at the end of that instruction. You were trying to write that off over a rather large, significant entry into the subroutine, the fetching of the data, the fetching of the instruction. This dominated the whole instruction, so your effort was to make as big and fat an instruction as possible so as you would get more execution time and on the average pay a percentage-wise lesser penalty for the overhead into the subroutine. So you had this rich and powerful instruction set here. The question is, do you need it any longer? If you're at a higher level language, writing in Fortran or anything else, doesn't really make any difference, do you need a machine instruction, in the conventional sense of the word, level before you go into the micro-instruction level? This is basically an unanswered question. There's a number of feelings. Some people feel that you're going to need this, if not exactly in the sense of, say, a 360 instruction, you're going to need some intermediate target language, and perhaps we can define a better one someplace between here and here. Perhaps we can't. Perhaps the best move is from here directly into the micro-instruction. But this is one open area of research, I would say. People have feelings on it. There's no proof as to which is the better way. It is clear, at least on a hand-coded basis, that to operate from here, directly into here, versus this intermediate procedure using, say, a BAL, a 360-type coding as an intermediate level, this coding, for significant non-numeric problems, gives you almost an order of magnitude improvement in performance. Now, whether that comes at too high an expense in terms of a user being able to program this level or writing a compiler, etc., or the size of the code that it takes to do that, this is an unanswered question. I think people will agree, though, that to go directly from here to here gives you faster execution. But whether or not the other parameters balance is an open question. Emulation is a significant application and will remain a significant application of microprogramming. There's no question about that. And the availability of this fact, these 10 or 20 micro-instructions for one conventional instruction is a powerful force in the retention of the emulation application. Eventually, emulation will presumably lose its significance. Emulation, at least in the sense of talking about specific host machines as distinct from some newly defined intermediate level here. But clearly, if we come out with a fourth generation, it will, or sooner or later, be not so significant to emulate 7090s, let's hope. They die hard, but eventually they die, one would imagine. A third application is the microdiagnostic, a third major future direction. Microdiagnosis is a very efficient and important technique in fault location in a system. It's very important and significant because it allows you to operate at the level where you're experiencing the failure, at the combinational level. If you try to diagnose with the instruction level, you wind up having to execute a sequence of perhaps 12 or 13 cycles. All right, this is this fixed overhead I was talking about, the fetching of the instruction, the generation of the address, the fetching of the data. This fixed entry into the instruction, you have to execute all this before you can do something distinguishable from another instruction. And it's only this distinguishability which allows you the diagnostic differentiability, and hence the location of the fault. So it takes a great a larger number of this type of instruction to find the fault than it would of this kind, which is directly attacking the fault. So you get a rather significant performance improvement in your fault locating techniques by directly using the micro instructions. This is called microdiagnostics. Finally, the other main immediate thrust for microprogramming is due to engineering reasons. We have LSI technology, whose main cost consideration is replication. You pay $25,000 for a mask, and it's imperative that you write that single mask over as many items as possible in the system. Now, the control to the old-style conventional control using a set of Boolean equations gave you the most horrendous and irregular and unique set of partitioning, if you will, of logical blocks that one could imagine. So unless you were some very large manufacturer who could produce 100,000 machines of exactly the same kind, which is even hard for IBM, unless you were that unique in that unique a position, you had really no right or no interest in using LSI in the control area. Now with microprogramming, of course, you're using storage for the control, and you do have the replication, and so from a simple engineering point of view, it's a cheaper way to do business, and hence it has a lot of immediate interest. On a longer term, I believe that over the next 5 years, we will be solving this higher direct translation or compilation of higher level languages into microcode. This is the first and largest external trend. Also directly executable higher-level languages, executable in the microprogramming sense. Internally, the internal trends, how the system will change within its architectural structure is illustrated on the next slide. First way is by simultaneous resource management, the way I'd like to say it anyway. It's really the creation of more powerful micro-instructions. Implicit in what I said before is a notion that the micro instruction is a primitive instruction and much less powerful than a conventional instruction, second and third generation. But if one rethinks the whole organization of the system, it does not have to be that much less powerful. Now let me describe that translation briefly. In a second and third generation system, one pays a price of, let's say, 13 or 14 cycles of overhead to get into the subroutine, the body of the subroutine. And while there, he executes 5 or 6 cycles and finishes. Does it matter if he massively restructured his system, let's make the assumption, that instead of doing this execution of the instruction in 5 cycles, he could have done it in 2 cycles? Would he bother? Of course not, because he's facing a 13-cycle entry into the subroutine anyway. So there was a tendency, has been a tendency, in conventional systems, and in fact microprogram systems to date, not to take advantage of the massive parallelism which one can develop within the system. I don't mean parallelism in the sense of the horizontal instruction, although that's certainly a part of it. But I mean where one goes into the system and repartitions the resources, if you will, so that, for example, one creates an independent shifter and an independent adder and an independent register transfer mechanism, if you will, independent data paths, which can be used in a parallel way, rather than just saying, well, here is one or two resources, and here are all the possible control lines to them, now go use them, all right? Which is more the tendency of, let's say, the current microprogram systems, all right? Because when you go to use them, you find you can't keep anything in parallel, really. You can't do anything in parallel because there's only one or two resources to control anyway. But by repartitioning the resources, so you do have an independency, then you can actually take advantage of this horizontal structure and develop powerful instruction sets at the micro level. There's no reason why these can't be essentially as powerful by restructuring the whole data path, the whole system itself, as the conventional instruction. At least that's my thesis. Another problem, notice we made the instruction bigger in the horizontal instruction that I showed before. Sooner or later, that instruction gets so overwhelming that we have really traded space for time, and as you know, this is a rather linear trade, and it doesn't make much difference if indeed you're always expanding the space to save time. The cost remains about the same, or one could certainly assert that anyway. Developments are on the horizon, however, which could alter that. And this is really using older techniques, whereby one uses a smaller micro instruction and then uses something called setup registers. Now, the concept of a setup register or residual control goes something like this. If I'm going to emulate or run a series of programs, which are going to emulate, just for example, a 7094, the adder size will be 36 bits. Now, my physical adder over here might indeed be 48 bits. But once I determine for this program that the adder size is 36 bits, I want to stay with that parameter. So what I do is I set that up, if you will. I'm able to control all of the lines of the system, and I load a certain value into a setup register. And that one of these lines will come over and, for example, cause an overflow out of the 36th bit instead of the 48th bit, and all of the other bits will be permanently turned off, permanently, until I load another value into the setup register. This gives me a type of global definition of the system, which is, of course, continually variable with a minimum amount of overhead. It also allows me to solve the problem which I had just introduced, really, in the last slide, by expanding the size of the microinstruction. The problem, of course, with this is a syntactic problem or a view problem, because we view microprogramming as a sequence of independent subroutines. And one can't do that with this residual control phenomenon. And work can't easily do it, I should say. And one must at least be careful to recognize the parameter passing difficulties that we're introducing by this. Finally, there's at least two other applications or future development. Microprogramming is good for one level of a processor. As processors develop and get more sophisticated, of course, one could envision a master micro storage or micro programming controlling many execution units, each one being in turn microprogrammed. So systems which have intrinsic parallelism in them, they can be represented by a hierarchy of microprogram stores. So this could be one possible further term development, now looking way out in the future. And finally, if microprogramming has been good from an engineering point of view, what we're really saying is storage is good. It's easy to implement. It's easy to check. It has many virtues, if you will. And one could argue, again, over even longer term view, that taking function out of the logic and returning it to storage will be a long-term trend. This is like table lookup logic, except that, as you know, the combinatorics blow up astronomically if it's not done prudently and with careful attention. And there are some developments along this line, in particular by Gartner at IBM in England, which indicates that there may be other solutions which would allow one to reflect more functions into storage, and instead of having this just relate to control microprogramming, rather it could relate and we could perhaps have a whole processor built out of storage. In any event, these are the trends that I see looking into my cloudy crystal ball. Thank you.
Have you given any thought or do you see any possibilities for having the microdiagnostics of effectiveness of microprogramming help us also in the problem of establishing the correctness of programs?
Offhand, I'd have to say no, but I... the whole area, though, of applying techniques of diagnostics to programming is an interesting thought. I just can't answer the question, John. It's a worthwhile suggestion.
Do you see future mini-computer designs taking advantage of microprogram control units?
Absolutely. I spoke with someone from a nameless, very large mini-computer company, and he was... And he was saying to me that, could one possibly conceive of a mini computer with 100 nanosecond storage? You know, it just seemed to boggle the mind. And my feeling, as I said to him, was wait 5 years and it won't boggle your mind anymore. All right? Everyone will be there, and you better be there early. So my feeling is the one that's not there won't be around very long after that.
Do you foresee the concept of a cache coming into use in interpreting control store?
The cache exists only because a particular conventional instruction set exists. All right? The whole purpose of the cache is to make a fast memory invisible to the particular user. So long as that situation exists, so long as one is forced to remain with a system whose instruction set was designed about this premise of slow storage, right? So long as that's true, then a cache has validity. Cache, I mean now, by cache, I mean a transparent fast store, a store that the programmer can't see. It's my faith, I guess, in programmers, that they can program better an explicit store if, indeed, they have the instructions to work with to do this. Because if worse came to worse, they could always program a cache.
Thank you. That's just what we're doing. We had a presentation by Don Gibson from IBM, who is very central in the development of cache, at the same time that a group who works with me in microprogramming, interested in microprogram machine organization, was just getting its feet very wet, looking at very particular potential implementations of systems that we expected to acquire, or one in particular. We discovered, well, one of our people said, what is the page-turning algorithm you use in your cache? I suspect the terminology was, I don't think the terminology was strange to him, but I don't think he expected it in the context of cache. But indeed, that's what it is. And finally, after we got across the question, he said, well, we experimented with several, and we found it doesn't make any difference because when you look at a large mix of programs, they're all the same. But we all know that the answer to that is nonsense. If I'm running my payroll program for half an hour every Friday afternoon, I damned well can predict how I should be turning pages, and in our microprogramming group, we intend to simulate at a hardware level, at a very fast level, exactly that kind of thing, and see what we can come up with. But you need the right kind of machine in which to do that.
Our next speaker is Professor Bob Rosen, who is at the Computer Science Department at the State University of New York in Buffalo. Bob is very well known in the field of microprogramming. He's had a wide association with this type of activity, both with the people in the industry and the people in the computer science departments, and has also written several excellent articles in this field. He is going to give us a talk today on the system implementation an application of microprogramming. Bob?
Thanks, Dick. If I can take exception with what you just said, I think I'm talking about the system implementation applications of microprogramming. There's no... Okay. I say that for the following reason. I was asked to give a talk on applications of microprogramming. My own predilections are that most of us in the computer field, whether we like it or not, are in the business of implementing systems, and therefore, I would like to look at microprogramming as one tool or technique that might be used in that task. Some of what I have to say might be considered, at least in an IEEE meeting, to be philosophical. I'm sure other people will ascribe other adjectives to it. What I'm going to display here is probably to some of you, complete heresy, but that's really quite all right. Our only job in a university is to stimulate thought. The truth really comes out in other places, I suspect. I don't want to offer as a paradigm a hierarchy of systems, where system is taken in the broadest possible context, with, again, the understanding that what I want to talk about is how to implement systems, or the task of implementing systems. With respect to each system, I will define a user, or a kind of user, and a characteristic of that system. For example, at the lowest level, perhaps in the computer field, what could be identified as germane in the computer field, is a chip, a functional unit which today can be bought off the shelf, as one of my friends said, Sears and Roebuck style, which is used by a logic designer in implementing something that we'll come to at the next level, and its characteristic is pretty much an electronic device. But indeed, it's a system. It's got inputs and outputs and some certain characteristics. It certainly isn't a computer, and I don't mean to imply that it's a computer. It could be characterized that way, but that would be far-fetched. Next, we come up with blocks, functional blocks, that are used by a device designer, and their characteristic, again, is logical rather than electronic, and it's the components he uses to build things which perhaps are marketed as physical units. These physical units are the components the system designer sees, and their characteristic more than anything else is functional. They're broadly functional. They're perhaps understood best in terms of natural language rather than some theoretic approach. Now, we're next level going to jump into something that most of you will recognize as computers, and I certainly believe is a computer. And that is what one might call the nucleus system, that thing which is marketed as a collection of hardware and a minimal collection of software, a nucleus system that includes input-output control system, perhaps a simple monitor, perhaps an assembler program. It's used by the system programmer, and I ascribe to that the characterization usable. That is, with a great deal of effort, someone might employ that system. I do not mean that it has any of the characteristics that I will bring forth in a moment. Now, the next level up, there's the application programmer who hopes to take advantage of an operating system with languages. Now, here the distinction in the IEEE domain becomes important, because as far as the fellow is concerned who is using this operating system, say with a Fortran compiler or a COBOL processor or something, he finds himself confronted with an exploitable system. It's one that can really be taken advantage of. And as far as he's concerned, he doesn't really care, and hold your gasps until I finish this whole phrase, he doesn't really care whether or not there's hardware underneath, and he certainly doesn't care what hardware is underneath. At least we should provide a system so that he shouldn't have to care. That is, his job is to write programs, not to worry about hardware. Now, I appreciate, in the Institute for Electrical and Electronic Engineers, part of our job is to build hardware. On the other hand, I submit to you that this application programmer doesn't care about that. Next level up, we see someone we might call the user faced with an applicable system, a system which somehow is tailored toward the needs of some particular application area. And this system is very often really, really consists of a set of software packages, a payroll package, for example, an analysis of variance package. It's that package which makes the system applicable for his purposes. And finally, we come up with the highest level of all, or perhaps from our point of view, the lowest level of all. That is the dedicated application-oriented system, that which is unavoidable, that which society wants and needs and uses because it really satisfies a need. For example, I flew up here or down here this morning on American Airlines. Many of you have flown that system. You recognize that all these fine young ladies and gentlemen who sit at the IBM typewriters scattered throughout this country are conversing with a machine. As far as they're concerned, that machine has a language. It might just as well be a standalone computer. As a matter of fact, it's important that that's all they understand. It's important that they're not quite aware of the fact that up in Briarcliff, somewhere along the Hudson, there are piles and piles of hardware and rapidly spinning disks and cursing systems engineers and so forth, making that typewriter look like something which to them is useful. Indeed, that's a system which is unavoidable. Now, the reason I dare mention this sort of thing in a talk on microprogramming is that I'm really concerned with system implementation. And I submit to you the following thesis, and I think it's something that we all ought to be aware of when we go about our daily lives and enjoying ourselves. Society is not prepared to pay the systems programmer to play. Computers do not exist because systems programmers have fun. Computers do not exist because logic designers need jobs or because they enjoy their tasks. In fact, computers only exist for that ultimate user, that guy who has to have the system. I offer you the following story, which is true because I heard it happen. Edward Moore, who is now at the University of Wisconsin and a fairly prominent automata theorist, said many years ago, I hope he still holds this belief, that automata theorists were second-order parasites on science. He said this was true because they purport to solve problems that programmers dream up, and programmers are first-order parasites on science. Said the only reason they have for their justification is that there are other people out there with real problems to solve. And I think that's indeed true. And in a situation that we're faced with in this country at this time, an economic situation and an anti-technological movement that we see, particularly in certain universities, I think we ought to keep some of these ideas in mind as we go about our job of being logic designers or systems programmers or whatever. Okay, now back to the theme which I was assigned. System implementation. It's difficult to talk about using microprogramming in systems implementation without offering some points of view about systems implementation. And again, I'll take this in the broadest sense, although my history as a programmer, I'm afraid, is going to show through. It doesn't bother me. I submit to you there are two primary methods to build a system. It might be used to build a system, realize a system, if you will. One is simulation. For example, I can take a System 360 or an 1108, write a program which simulates a machine whose language is Fortran. I call that a Fortran interpreter. But in fact, what I'm really doing is writing a simulator. In very much the same sense that Dick Merwin talked about a simulator for a microprogrammable machine, my Fortran interpreter is a simulator of a machine whose machine language is Fortran. Another approach to that is the emulation of the 370 on the 3165, which is merely a program in the writable control store, although it's not announced that way, writable control store of the IBM 3165 processor, which makes it look like a 370. If I take away the microprogram and put something else there instead, a different one, I have got a different machine. The microprogram is merely a program, or a description, if you will, of a simulation of some system. By changing that description, or changing that program, I have changed the ultimate reality which faces me. In particular, if I replace, well, this is a little far-fetched example, but those who know otherwise, bear with me. If I replace that microprogram in the 370-165, which makes it look like a 370, with a different microprogram, I might use the 3165 central processor as, for example, a 7094. Why not? Now, the other approach, traditionally, to implementing machines or implementing systems is translation. That is, rather than build a Fortran interpreter on some machine, I might build a Fortran compiler, a program which takes a Fortran program, transforms it into another program which has the same characteristics, but which is written in a different language. For example, the language of 360. Another example of that same kind of thing is a machine, a microprogram, if you will, which makes the 370 have the characteristics of a universal computer-oriented language machine, an UNCLE machine, which was described in the literature back in 1958. One argument which one hears fairly often and with which I tend to agree is that in reality, System 360 and System 370 were IBM's attempts to build a universal computer-oriented language machine, a machine which could be applied universally equally well to a variety of tasks. Now, those two concepts, simulation and translation, I suggest are actually endpoints of a continuum. Reality of implementing any particular system has components of both. There's no such thing as a Fortran translator which doesn't also have a runtime environment which is, if you will, interpreted. There's no such thing as a Fortran interpreter there shouldn't be any such thing as a Fortran interpreter which doesn't make an early pass over the source program to transform it into something which is better interpreted, better simulated. So reality in any particular system is someplace in between. Well, I submit to you that these concepts also apply in the hardware domain. These aren't the traditional approaches taken in the hardware domain in the sense of the names that I've used, but I believe the processes are rather similar. And indeed, what one builds, or what one arrives at most generally when he builds a computer of hardware, is a simulator of something built out of a pile of hardware. The story or the analogy I like to draw is the 7094. One would believe that the 7094 somehow is God-given. If I wheel it into the room, it will do 7094 code. I submit to you, however, with a soldering iron and a pair of wire clippers, I can make that machine execute meaningful programs of a very different nature without adding or subtracting to the current hardware component of the system. Indeed, it's the organization and structure of the thing that makes a difference. But what I'm doing is using a pile of physical components to build a simulator of some system. The system itself is a concept which can be realized many different ways. Let me not go into that now. Okay, what are the requirements of using this approach to building systems? Well, I suggest to you that there are three. There are, first of all, that one considers a process to be a hierarchy of routines, or a hierarchy of processes, if you prefer, which are linked together in some way by parameters and by a calling sequence. Now, those are programmers' terms for things which you all well understand. If multiplication is an important thing in the computer you're building, you go out and build a multiply box, and when the time comes, you go off and tickle it. I suggest to you that's a multiply subroutine, and indeed, it is a component that exists in a hierarchy of things. Another concept, which I believe is useful if we're going to realize systems in a consistent and purposeful manner, is generality of facilities. How often have we seen machines in which there's a collection of 15 registers, some of which are 18 bits wide, some of which are 17 bits wide, some of which are 30 bits wide, and two of which are 3 bits wide. And heaven forbid the day comes when you need another 17-bit register, or when one of those 3-bit registers really ought to be 4. Why, when we sit around and count bits, can't we understand that somewhere down the line, that system may have another life in which, for example, a uniform set of 16-bit registers or 18-bit registers is what we really want and what's going to make the system live for longer than that one application we see for it today? Why do we have to talk about one register using one addressing concept and another register using a totally different addressing concept? Let's put them in the same addressing space and talk about them as equals. So indeed, we may use them as equals, so we can exploit the hardware that's there rather than run away from it because it's hidden from us. And finally, I suggest to you, much against the advice of some of the more learned gentlemen in this field, that we need a higher level language for talking about these things. We need a higher level language for describing these kinds of processes, these hierarchies of routines that talk about general facilities, and I think we need a higher level language for implementing those processes. What I'm saying is we need a higher level language for microprogramming, which of course is in a sense the antithesis of what one hears when he looks at real machines. How on earth could you develop a higher level language which would exploit the hardware of the 2050 with those 90-bit wide control words that have so very many special and subtle fields and make the thing run efficiently? You're going to throw away a few microseconds now and then, and you can't afford to do that. Well, I will offer you the same argument I've offered to others elsewhere. I'm willing to stake my reputation on this, whatever that's worth. And that is in 1957, when the IBM Corporation was first introducing the Fortran language and the associated compiler. There are a whole bunch of people older and wiser than I, and probably older and wiser than most of you, who said that Fortran would never be used by people who had to write real programs running half a day long because it was going to produce object code that was too inefficient. It'll never be used in the aircraft industry, all the guys out in the West Coast said. Well, we know that's not true. We know that the only thing that has made computers even accessible to the vast majority of people who have real problems to solve are languages like Fortran and COBOL, whether or not they take advantage of the machine. Recall again that as far as society is concerned, it needs systems that are unavoidable, that solve society's problems, not which use machines well. Using machines well is another consideration. It turns out that in most computing centers today, I have this on authority from a good friend of mine at a fairly well-known company and a large user of computers for real things, that fewer than 35% of their computer dollars are spent on hardware today. That it's almost all management, programming personnel, overhead, etc. So don't get too uptight about the fact that your machine might lose a microsecond now and then. The question is, can it be used? And I submit to you that higher level languages for microprogramming will make them usable. I also have it on good authority from one of my students whose first draft of his doctoral dissertation is in my briefcase, that indeed it's going to happen, because he's done a good chunk of it. Okay, now what I was asked to talk about were applications of microprogramming. Having gone through all this diatribe on one man's view of computer systems, or at least what the software people... Okay, what software people's views of computer systems were, let me tell you about this. I've got 7 applications. I'll run through them since I ran out of time. First is realization of computers. For example, the 370 product line. I think the point about the family of computers concept was apparently paramount in IBM's mind when they took this approach, but apparently it's paid off in other ways that I'll talk about as we go through this scheme. One of the other applications of microprogramming one sees today is support for earlier machines on later machines. For example, IBM supports 1400 series machines on the 2025 CPU, which happens to be the machine which also supports 360 model 25. Support for earlier operating systems under new systems. I submit to you that whereas before people were worried about emulating, whatever that means, old machines on new machines, I believe people in the future are going to discover that the real marketplace is not emulating 360, but emulating the operating systems that run on 360. Nobody is ever going to emulate 360 I/O, including IBM, after a while. But what they will emulate are what are called the access methods, which are used to link to 360 I/O. And one example of this is the emulation of DOS, the disk operating system, under IBM's operating system on System 370, which is also done with a hardware boost. Realization of special devices is another application of microprogramming. Integrated controllers, as we've seen in some recent IBM announcements, and I believe announcements that have been made and will be forthcoming from other manufacturers, rely heavily on the use of microcoded general-purpose hardware inside the system to supplant what normally was special-purpose controllers that existed attached to devices. The array processors, which one sees, special-purpose devices that look to the system like I/O devices and provide ancillary support for particular applications, and graphics machines. One of the interesting things about a graphics environment is that traditional linear core storage is a particularly poor host for supporting the kinds of displays or the information that drive displays in graphics systems. And I believe, for reasons that I'll elucidate in just a second, that microprogramming will have a big part to play here. More speculative, but still coming down the pipe, are user-oriented systems. For example, systems that execute languages like Snowball 4 directly. I don't submit to you directly in machine language because I don't know where machine language is anymore. Fortran machines, which I talked about. The Alan Babcock people who have built extensions to 360 for supporting a higher level language machine. And finally, machines which support operating system functions directly in, quote, hardware, whatever that is. System maintenance and development has been pointed out. 360, 85, microdiagnostics. More importantly, however, was the fact some of you may be aware of that about 1968, IBM discovered under much pressure from its customers that the floating point definition in System 360 indeed was inadequate to cope with certain problems that arise in the customer domain. They made a decision, a very tough decision, to retroactively retrofit all machines in the field, all 360s in the field, which then numbered somewhere around 30,000. And those of you who aren't from IBM will understand those are large numbers. Retrofit those machines in the field with a new floating point unit. Fortunately for IBM and its customers, most of the machines in the field were low model number machines, and redefinition of floating point in many cases merely meant changing the contents of control store on those machines with no hardware modifications at all. Indeed, the user thought the hardware was modified, but nothing had happened. I submit if that weren't the case, if those machines had not been plastic underneath, the change never would have been made. It would have been too expensive. And finally, enhancement of system performance is another application of microprogramming. Instructions that do fast Fourier transform analysis, table search instructions, things like this are things which microprogramming will support well. I just have one more slide which I'm going to show, Dick, and then I'll quit. One of the things that's been said here today is that what we're interested in is definition of instructions. I believe it's true that the way one approaches microprogramming indeed is by defining instructions. However, I think what's crucial in everything I've put forth so far, and let me now underline that, is that instruction definition is really a secondary issue. Most applications today do not rise or fall on the basis of a presence or absence of a particular instruction in a particular machine's instruction set. What is critical is the concept of structured data and how well those data are supported in machines. Let me go back to the graphics environment. A simple display in a graphics environment consists of a large number of numeric data or alphabetic data stringed together by pointers, by addresses. Conventionally in a machine, we have to tie those things together through pointers, and then when we want to build a display, we have to back up and bring all that kludge together into some nice linear form so the scope can recognize it. What indeed if we could microprogram, for example, our scope driving routines to search dynamically through chain data? Why should we tie our machines, our virtual machines, our conceptual machines, to the concept of data which hardware provides us? I suggest to you that microprogramming is going to offer us, the users, a way to break that bond and get at the kind of data we want by defining those data structures in the microprogrammable domain. Okay, thank you.
I've referred to 360 Model 85 microdiagnostics. What are they?
This allows me an opportunity to make a plug. Not for any of my own work. One way to find out is by looking, not necessarily at the 85, but I'll get to the 85 in a second, by looking at the preprints of the third annual workshop on microprogramming, co-sponsored by IEEE and ACM SIG Micro, which are available from ACM headquarters. $750 for members of SIG Micro, $10 for non-members. There are a couple of articles in there on microdiagnostics, or actually four, I guess, which you may find to be of interest. I don't think there's one on the 85. There was an article published on the 85 in the last Spring Joint Computer Conference. The fact is, oh, there's one on the 145, where? Oh, in the third annual workshop, there's one on the 370-145. The last year was on the 85. It's very difficult to diagnose a machine when that machine doesn't really exist. Or if you will, from another point of view, it's very difficult to diagnose an IBM 2030 CPU, which has a particular instruction set, and data set, address space, and so forth, when there is no way to address the hardware facilities of the 2030 CPU, because the only thing that you see is a 360 emulator on top of it. Those machines which have a writable control store, and to a certain extent those machines which don't, I have to be very careful about that, but those machines like the 85, which have a writable control store, or partially writable control store, allow the customer engineer, the maintenance people in the field, to go in and build hard diagnostic routines on demand, if you will, to exercise the real hardware that exists, rather than the virtual hardware which the emulator supports. In terms of fault isolation and so forth, that happens to be rather critical, and as Professor Wilkes pointed out in his talk the other day here, which is in the digest of this conference, that appears to be one of the more promising applications of microprogramming.